And this is CPRMetro.org, Community Progressive Radio. My name is Bernard White, and the name of this program is Wake Up Call. And now we turn our attention to the continent of Africa. Many of us who follow the news are aware of the U.S. launching a military force under the name AFRICOM. What makes AFRICOM unique is that it was established to be a rapid deployment force on the continent of Africa. Donald Rumsfeld, one of its architects, claims that the force will operate as a humanitarian force there to serve the Africans. Those of us who are students of history know that the U.S. military is not a humanitarian organization. They generally operate in the interests of U.S. corporations. They make the land that they occupy safe. Safe for corporate exploitation of its natural resources. Most folks didn't know anything about AFRICOM until four of its members were killed in Niger. Now questions are being raised. How many troops are on the continent? Where are they deployed? In what capacity? What is their mission? In something that is rare for black preachers, Dr. Reverend Ray Hagins, founder of the African Village and Cultural Center in St. Louis, Missouri, talks to his congregation about the origin and mission of AFRICOM.
Kazuma Furlow called me and After answering his call and giving and receiving the greetings from each other, he asked me if I had ever heard of AFRICOM. And I told him that I hadn't heard of it before. How many of you, before receiving the email, ever heard of AFRICOM? Let's put it this way, how many of you do not know about AFRICOM? Look at the hands. Everybody, keep your hands up, everybody look around. You see? Thank you. As he was talking to me on the phone, I Googled it. And a whole lot of sites came up. And the first site that I clicked on was the Wikipedia site that gave its synopsis of AFRICOM. AFRICOM is spelled, it's an acronym. It's spelled AFRICOM. Wikipedia describes AFRICOM as this, and I quote, "The United States Africa Command, USA AFRICOM, US AFRICOM, or AFRICOM, is a," check this out now, "it is a unified combatant command of the United States Department of Defense that is responsible for U.S. military operations in and military relations with 53 African nations, an area of responsibility covering all of Africa except Egypt. Africa Command was established October 1st, 2007, as a temporary sub-unified command of United States European Command. But it became fully autonomous and operational on October 1st, 2008. How long ago did I just say? October 1st, 2008. What is that, 4 months ago? 3 months ago? Well, today, 4 months ago, thank you. When it officially took command of United States military operations within the aforementioned area of responsibility, meaning all 53 countries of Africa. Africa has 54 countries in it. All 53 countries are now under the influence of United States Military Operational Command all over the continent of Africa. Now, of course, when Pastor Kazuma shared this with me, I got upset. I really did, because I wanted to know, when did the United States of America need to become a fully autonomous combatant entity in every country in Africa? Except Egypt. And I'll be honest with you. It would have included Egypt too, if Egypt would have allowed it. Being ex-military, as I read about AFRICOM, I went through a whole lot of emotional changes. Because I know that whenever the United States of America proposes to go into another country,
tell the truth,
it's only to their advantage.
Say that. Say that.
And in the best interest of the United States of America.
All right.
Yes.
They always say they're going in to help. They're going in to assist and aid in this and help fund this and help build this and all that kind of stuff. Don't y'all believe that, man? That's what hegemony is all about. It's deep because as I begin to do more research into this sinister plot, program, device, the words of Del Jones' song kept ringing in my mind, and his song called Slave Ship.
Yes, sir.
Well, right now.
And in his song, and it's something because Del Jones recorded that song and never performed it after that. Because while he was recording it, it was so emotionally painful for him that he just didn't perform it anymore. But in the song, you could hear him pleading, saying, ancestors, please help the people to see. They won't listen to me.
That's right.
As Elder Kazuma continued talking, y'all, I could hardly digest what he was saying because my mind was engaged in a panoramic and retrospective view of so many of the things that I had taught over the last 17 years about this government and what agenda they have up their sleeve.
That's right.
For black people. Talking about its foreign and domestic policies. And then as I continued to research, the question came to my mind, which was the question in my email, why didn't Barack Obama tell us about Africa? Well, Barack Obama is now the president of the United States of America, and finally, finally, I have the answer that I needed as to why there was so much media attention on this election. Because never in the history of this country have there been more of a media circus.
That's right.
Than it has been over the last couple of years leading up to this election. And some of you, I even told some of you, I don't know, I shared Minister Stewart, maybe Minister, I don't know, several people, I said, you know what, this government is up to something.
That's right, you know it.
This government is up to something because they are focusing too much attention on something that don't deserve that much attention.
All right.
There's a book put out by Ralph Epperson called The Unseen Hand. If you don't have that book, brothers and sisters, I encourage you to get it. If you don't have the book, I encourage you to get it. It's called The Unseen Hand. What is The Unseen Hand all about? In this book, Ralph Epperson exposes one of the most effective tactics that the government uses when they want to create and implement something that they know the people of America are not going to agree with. That tactic is called distraction.
Yeah.
That's why it's called the unseen hand. In other words, what they do is they show you this. They say, hey, look at this hand. Look what I'm doing over here. Look at this. And you put all your attention on this hand while they're doing their dirt with the other hand,
yes,
and you don't see it.
Yes, sir.
Well, brothers and sisters, not only were the people in America distracted, people all over the world were distracted by the past election service.
Yep.
And so many thousands of our people are still rejoicing over what they think they did. Did y'all hear how I said that?
Yes, sir.
Over what they think they did by getting out there and voting. This was truly the greatest distraction of all time. I don't know how many of you have heard me teach about the National Security Council Memorandum 46.
Yes.
You know what? Just in case you have not seen it, let me pull it up for those of you who haven't. Now, I'm going to be doing a lot of screen work today because I want y'all to see some stuff. But let me pull up this document for you guys. Okay, for those who have, how many of you have not seen National Security Council Memorandum 46? You have not read it before. Okay, good. All right, then give me a moment. I'm going to show y'all some of the points that it brings up. Okay. Where are we at? Here we go. And I encourage you to write this down. National Security Council Memorandum 46, that's NSCM/46, all right? And also NSCM/200. Now, both of these are National Security Council memorandums. How many of y'all have ever heard of the National Security Council before? Okay, good. The National Security Council is a very powerful organization. Branch of the government. You see, the National Security Council and the National Security Agency can get laws passed without it going to Congress. Under the banner or under the claim of for the sake of national security. In other words, if they say something is needed for the sake of national security, then there's no need to even vote on it. Because national security takes preeminence over everything else. You see what I'm saying? So what they do is they draft the document and take it to the president and get him to sign off on it, and it automatically becomes law. So these laws are put in place without the knowledge of the American public and without the knowledge of most of the people on Capitol Hill. And it's done under something called, I'm sure you've heard this word, at least you've heard it since Obama's been in office. You've probably heard me talk about it too. Everybody hear this phrase? Presidential executive orders?
Yes.
You've heard that before, right? You see, that's the power that the president has to sign a bill into law without an act of Congress. Now, that ain't supposed to happen. The Constitution created three branches of government. The judicial branch, the legislative branch, and the executive branch. Thank you. And each branch is supposed to monitor the other ones. It's the checks and balances. The executive branch is supposed to make laws. So the president is not supposed to have that power. Okay? But Senate Bill 2834, the Senate Authorization Act, gave George Bush Sr., had that bill passed, which gives the president the power to now act legislative and judicial. Am I making sense, y'all?
Sure.
Okay. Thank you, Brother Ricky. As you see here, family, this document, let me get my pointer. National Security Council, Memorandum 46, let me kind of make this a little bit smaller so everybody can kind of see it. Okay, what's the date on this?
March 17th.
Thank you. March 17th, 1978. Who was the president then?
Carter.
Jimmy Carter. Now, see, in order to really understand the sinister activity behind AFRICOM, you got to know about this. Because it's like movies number one, but it was done back in 1978. Notice the subject of it. Black Africa and the United States Black Movement. In other words, this National Security Council was written to say, and you've heard me say this, we must never allow black people to empower themselves. We must never allow black people in America to unite and empower themselves. We must never allow black people in Africa to unite and empower themselves. And we must never allow black people in America to unite with black people in Africa, because it will become a threat to the national security of the United States of America.
That's right.
The document says it, family. Okay, what I want to do is just kind of scroll down here and highlight certain points. Now, by the way, so y'all don't think I'm making this up, who is this by?
Brzezinski.
The big new Brzezinski. Sound familiar?
Yes.
For those of you who are real young and don't know much about the history of this man, Zbigniew Brzezinski, security advisor under Jimmy Carter. Y'all following me? This is the man who put this thing together. Zbigniew Brzezinski, let me just call him the devil. This devil is the one who compiled this National Security Council memorandum. And as you see, his focus is on what continent?
Africa.
Africa. Is it indeed?
Yes.
It's not a coincidence, family, that this same man, this same demon, this same devil, is also Barack Obama's chief advisor.
Right.
What is he still doing out here in politics all these years later? He was old in 78. Him and Henry Kissinger.
Yes.
Y'all following me?
Yes. Yes.
It's not an accident here, family. This man's agenda is being carried out. As painful as what I'm about to say is, repeat this after me. God help us.
God help us.
Because we have a black man, with the mind of Zbigniew Brzezinski. What are you saying, Dr. Ray? Don't you understand, family? And it dawned on me, I've been dealing with this thing here, y'all. And I've come to, I could be wrong. I hope I'm wrong. I could be wrong. But it dawned on me, Barack hasn't been around long enough to even know what's going on. The man only been in politics a few years.
Right.
He's a new kid on the block. He's a big new Brzezinski. Handpicked him when he was a college student. Took him under his wing, under his armpit. Taught him, groomed him, trained him, and is now de facto his daddy in world affairs. So whatever Zbigniew Brzezinski tells this young politician known as Barack Obama, Barack Obama's gonna do it because his daddy says so. I don't give a cheesecake who don't like what I'm saying. Look at this, y'all. The objective of our policy toward toward Black Africa. Now, mind you, again, this is written in 78.
Right.
How many years ago is that?
30,
almost 31 years ago. The objective of our policy, where was Barack Obama 31 years ago? Thank you! He was a youngster. He was a minor. The objective of our policy toward Black Africa is to prevent social upheavals which could radically change the political situation throughout the area. Now, what do they mean by social upheavals? In other words, we intend on going in and taking over Africa. But we must put something in place to prevent social upheavals when we try to do this. U.S. interest in Black Africa. This is some deep stuff, y'all.
It sure is.
Notice what it says. If Black African states assume attitudes hostile to what?
United States
national interest. I told you, whenever this country goes into another country, it's not for that other country's best interest. It's only for the interest of the United States. And it says, if Black African states, if Black folk in Africa wake up to what they're really trying to do and assume hostile attitudes toward us, our policy toward the white regimes, check this out now, which is a key element in our relations with the Black states, may be subjected by the latter to great pressure for fundamental change. Thus, the West, who is the West? The United States. North America. Europe. The West may face a real danger of being deprived of access to the enormous raw material resources of Southern Africa, which are vital for our defense needs, as well as losing control over the Cape Sea routes by which approximately 65% of Middle Eastern oil is supplied to Western Europe. In one paragraph, that's their whole agenda.
All right, tell the truth. Tell the truth.
Y'all see what I'm saying?
Yes, sir.
Woo! Let me go on down and read some more here. All right, I'm not going to read this whole document. You can read it on your own. Let's look at economics. Black Africa is increasingly becoming an outlet for U.S. exports and investment. Again, there it is. What's going to benefit the United States? The mineral resources of the area continue to be of great value for the normal functioning of industry where?
In the United States.
In other words, family, again, they're telling you, the only reason why the United States wants to go into Africa is to take the land.
Always.
For the resources.
Right.
Just like they said in the GAT conference. It was held in Johannesburg, South Africa. The leaders of the world, G8 and G20 nations, said, it is the resources of Africa that we want. The people of Africa we can do without. Okay, notice this. Wow. In order to prevent such a trend, and do what, y'all? And protect United States national security interests, it would appear essential to elaborate and carry out effective countermeasures. Wow. I'm not going to read this whole document. You can get it online. You can go to the website, WBOR.com, and get the whole thing. Okay? Let me just look at this last paragraph I have here. Internationally, damage can be done to the United States by coordinated activity of African states designed to condemn U.S. policy towards South Africa and initiate discussions on the United States racial issue at the United Nations, where the African representation constitutes a powerful bloc with about one-third of all the votes. So what must they do? They must create a program. They must devise something and put it in place. Oh, let me go back. Let's do it here. Look at the political options. In the context of, what did I say?
Long-term
strategy. What kind of strategy?
Long-term.
Look at somebody next to you and say, we have to understand, that these people, think 20 to 25 years ahead of us. Please understand that. In other words, whatever they're putting in place right now is so that your grandchildren will agree with it. Did y'all hear what I said? That's how strategic they are. That's why y'all need to come out here on Tuesday night and learn how to play chess.
Right, that's right.
I'm serious about this. You see, the game of chess will help you understand how these people think.
Right, right.
Because to play chess, you gotta think 8, 9, 10 moves ahead. Black folk, y'all, we're so busy just trying to make it to the end of the month. As far as most of us can see.
Yes, sir.
So it's hard for us to even grasp the reality that these people can think 2 generations down the road of what's going to happen.
Mm-hmm.
In the context of long-term strategy, notice what I said. People, look, I didn't write this. Zbigniew Brzezinski wrote this. The devil, one of them.
That's right, all right.
He said, the United States cannot afford a radical change in the fundamentals of its African policy, which is designed for maximum protection of national security. Y'all see it?
Yes.
So what are his recommendations? Wow. The range of United States interest in black, and weighing the range of United States interest in black Africa, here are the recommendations. Number one, specific steps should be taken with the help of appropriate government agencies, like the military, to inhibit coordinated activity of the black movement in the United States. Check this out. A special clandestine operation should be launched by the CIA to generate mistrust and hostility in American and world opinion against joint activity of the two forces. What two forces? Blacks in America and blacks in Africa, right? And to cause division among black African radical national groups and their leaders. Woo! The FBI should mount surveillance operations against black African representatives and collect sensitive information on those, especially at the United Nations, who oppose U.S. policy towards South Africa. The information should include facts on their links with their leaders of the black movement in the United States, thus making possible at least partial neutralization of the adverse effects of their activity. Let me go down and read the bottom point here. The range of policy options. The concern for the future security of who? Not Africa. For the future security of the United States makes necessary the range of policy options. And it says, it's just because they're in this order don't mean that one is more important than the other. Let me skip down to the one I really want you to see. Here it is. Notice their recommendation. To support the not. This is what this devil wrote. The same devil who hand-selected Barack Obama. Here's what he wrote. To support the nomination at federal and local levels of loyal black public figures to elective offices. God bless America. Take that back. God damn America.
Thank you.
In 1978, this man wrote in this national security memorandum that one of the things that's going to be necessary for us to implement our agenda is to get the nomination at federal and local levels of loyal black public figures to elected offices, to government agencies, and the court. This would promote the achievement of a twofold purpose. What twofold purpose might that be? One, first, it would be easier to control the activity of loyal black representatives within existing institutions. And two, second, the idea of an independent black political party, now under discussion within black leadership circles, would soon lose all support. Again, that's National Security Council Memorandum 46, written by Big New Brzezinski, Barack Obama's chief advisor. Y'all all right?
Yes, sir.
Now, the Brzezinski protege. That'd be a good book. The Brzezinski protege. His name happens to be Barack Obama. Is the commander-in-chief of AFRICOM. This is right here. In case it got past you, AFRICOM is the acronym of the United States military takeover of the entire continent of Africa, except Egypt. But then again, you gotta remember, the United States Census Bureau decided a few decades ago, that Egypt ain't in Africa.
Right.
Right.
The United States made that decision. Egypt is now in the Middle East. It's not considered an African country anymore. How is it that something of this magnitude was not mentioned in any of Obama's speeches? Not a word, not one word, not one thing was said about Africa. Maybe it's because he knew that if he said one word about AFRICOM, that black people would have said, wait a minute here, hold up. What you trying to do, man? You trying to get us to vote you in so that you can be the one who pushes the trigger for the elimination of 75% of the world's non-white population by 2050? And don't take, didn't I just tell you about National Security Council 200? That's what that said. That by 2050, over 4 billion people must die. It's called sustainable development. Please, don't take my word for what I'm saying. Check it out for yourself. Go to Google and just type in sustainable development or zero population growth, any of that. And you'll see the program comes up. Man, this stuff has been in the works for years. Now they got a young man who had no idea what was going on when they planned this in the first place. Here's a young man who they picked him and thrust him into the world of politics and swept him off his feet and gave him all this doggone attention. And before he could even get a chance to think well, before he could realize what was happening, he's in the spotlight and this is all right. You know, man, you want to run for president. You think so? Yeah, we want you to run for president. And that became his complete, total distraction. You see, I have to be honest with y'all, because I know some people think I'm against the Barack. I'm not against that man at all. I really believe that he has a good heart. I really do. What I also know is that he's owned by some sinister forces.
Yes. Yes.
And he will carry out their agenda, or they will kill him.
Right.
No ifs, ands, or buts about it.
right.
He loves his wife.
Right.
He loves his family.
Right.
And to spare their lives.
Right.
Man, who? That's why the ancestors gonna have to come help in this situation.
Yes.
That's exactly what has happened. Our people have been instrumental in being so distracted that we couldn't speak out against this. I'll be honest with you. If not one black person is voted, Barack Obama would still be the president.
Yes.
You got to understand.
Yes,
sir. If not one black person had voted, Obama would still be the president. So we didn't do anything. What we did do is we got distracted. And we missed this. The most insulting part of all is that the people who own Barack Obama, the Rothschilds, the Oppenheimers, these are the names y'all gonna hear in church. Okay, so you're gonna hear about Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John.
You're gonna hear
about Nebuchadnezzar, and Solomon, Daniel, and Ezekiel, and Jeremiah, Obadiah. That's who you're Paul. That's who you're going to hear about in church. Okay? That's why most black folk don't know anything about the Bilderberg group. Because Bilderbergers is not in the biblical text. The Schiffs are not in the Bible. The J.P. Morgans are not in the Bible. The Rockefeller are not in the Bible. Y'all grabbing what I'm saying? You see, and one thing that most preachers have to do, and they got to preach that Bible, or they'll get voted out of their churches. So, even if they know better, they don't want to lose the Lexus they got parked outside. So, they adopt the attitude of, my folk don't want to hear about that stuff. They want to hear about how the Lord is going to come and rescue them from this mess that we're in. That's what they want to hear about. Not the Hagen. When black preachers need to be educating black people about the power of the crown.
Yes.
All right.
You see, that's why the president cannot carry the office of king. Because, see, the United States is a corporation.
Yes, sir.
And it has a president. And the president has to do what its board of directors tell it to do. That's how this goes, people.
Yes.
The tragedy is that these powerful people have taken chocolate-colored men like Barack and William Kip Ward, who's the general, commanding general over this, as you see his name there.
Yes.
And others to carry this out. Why have they selected? See, George Bush was getting ready to do this. It was implemented under his administration. He just didn't tell y'all about it.
Right.
He said, let's let the chocolate man carry it out.
That's right.
See, let's put chocolate people over this so that when we invade Africa and take their natural resources, the chocolate people in Africa can't say that white folk came
in
here and did this.
That's right.
Talk to you, understand what I'm saying?
Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
slave oppressor would allow the black enslaved Africans to gather for church service.
Yes.
They couldn't gather for church service unless a white person was present to monitor everything that was said. Y'all follow what I'm saying? Well, guess what, y'all? Ain't nothing changed. Because their monitor now is Hillary Clinton. Hillary Clinton, the new Secretary of State, is the white monitor to make sure that the Negroes are doing what they're supposed to do in Africa. Don't take my word for what I'm saying. Go right here to this website. Go to google.com, type in AFRICOM, A-F-R-I-C-O-M, and when you pull up this website right here in this search box, just type the words Hillary Clinton, and you'll see Hillary Clinton's address before the Senate, where she outlines, now check this out, she outlines Barack Obama's Africa policy. Like his policy. Yeah, ain't that deep?
Yes, sir.
What's deep about it is she knew this all along.
Yeah.
Contrary to popular opinion, she knew she wasn't going to be president.
Right.
They had to put this in, they had in mind to take over Africa. And you know good and well they weren't going to let no white woman go in and invade Africa.
Right.
The thing was a charade. It was a distraction. She knew she was going to be the Secretary of State.
Right.
Barack knew he was going to be president. They promised that to him years ago. Because Brzezinski wants his agenda carried out. Y'all all right? You see, brothers and sisters, to our people, who are those who are listening to this on the internet, those who are got this DVD, CDs, those of you who are listening to our black people who so eagerly praised and supported the program to elect Obama. Now notice how I'm saying that. Because I'm not attacking you. Listen to what I'm saying. Those of you who so eagerly praised and supported the program to elect Obama, I have to congratulate you for your commitment. I have to congratulate you for your support to the agenda of the system that owns Obama. Mm. Did y'all hear how I said that?
Yes, sir.
I'm trying to say this as diplomatically and properly as I can. I have to congratulate our people for their commitment and support to the agenda of the system that owns Obama. I'm happy that you are happy. And some are very happy. You have done exactly what the powers that be wanted you to do. I know you didn't mean any harm. I know you didn't. Because just the idea of a black man becoming the president of the United States made you stop thinking just long enough for them to implement their program called AFRICOM with little or no resistance from the very people who are the children, grandchildren, and great-grandchildren of Mother Africa.
Yes, yes, sir.
Y'all hear me?
Yes, sir.
You see, in other words, y'all, if we had known about this,
yeah.
Don't feel bad. I didn't know about it either.
That's right.
When do we all raise our hands up? My hand, last Sunday, my hand went up with yours. Because, see, I was just as distracted as you were. I was distracted by you being distracted. And I'm trying to tell you to stop being distracted. I allowed you to distract me with you. You understand what I'm saying?
Yes, sir.
It's almost like the phrase, you can't hold a man down without staying down with him. Okay? Well, you can't stop people from being, spend too much time trying to stop people from being distracted, because then that distracts you too. You see? Oh man. Let me just show y'all a couple of things here. Brother Rick, if you will, you can just kind of focus the camera right there on the screen. I want brothers and sisters to hear some things here. First of all, again, I'm not going to go through this site. You see it here. Of course, this is the shoulder patch. I don't know if this makes it enlarge any larger. Let me click on it and see. There you go. That is the crest that military forces will wear on their shoulder.
Wow.
Ain't that a mess? United States Africa Command. That's the crest they created. Okay? Now let's kind of go back over here. The very country that they tell y'all to stay out of. What you want to go to Africa for? Ain't nothing in Africa. You need to go to France. Go to Hawaii.
Congo is like a nightmare in heaven. It's a heaven because, you know, Congo is the heart of Africa. So much natural resources, the people, the animals, the flowers, everything, you know. Congo is heaven, but the thing is that people are living like in hell. People are dying. At first, we used to hear 1 million people die, 2, 3, 4, 5. And the situation is getting worse and worse, you know, because the money is there, the resources are there in Congo, and everybody wants a piece of Congo. Everybody wants a piece of Congo.
Why are people living hand to mouth in one of the most mineral-rich countries in the world? The Congo produces more than $1 billion of gold alone each year.
And the cobalt and the tin and the copper and the tungsten, all of that we're benefiting from, but yet we're silent.
When people invade your country, they rape your women, they rape the kids, they morally control your mind.
There's a pattern to genocide. You can see it coming. I mean, it's like a hurricane.
Are we going to have to wait for 20 more years before somebody does something to stop this Holocaust?
There's a global consensus that exists that says it's okay for nearly 6 million black people to die in the heart of Africa and for us to be silent.
So I kept asking our intelligence people, is there any truth to this? I mean, what's happening out there?
I don't think policymakers could claim that they didn't know.
There's something wrong. There's something wrong with us in terms of the way we think about Africa.
The story of Congo is often overlooked for its complexity. It's a story where boundaries are porous and national identities mean little. Militant groups with ever-changing acronyms are not who they claim to be, and neighbors loot and murder while they are praised by the international community. But the death toll is now surpassing that of the Holocaust, in part because of the way the United States is involved in Central Africa. Now facing a critical juncture in their history, the Congolese people need us to change the way we're involved so that they can have the space to start rebuilding their country.
The first principle to understand about the Congo, the affairs of the Congo have not been determined by the people of the Congo. the national boundaries were formed at the Berlin Conference in 1885, when Congo was given to King Leopold II of Belgium as his own personal property.
He owned it for 23 years, and during that time made a huge fortune off the territory, estimated at well over $1 billion in today's American dollars, primarily from turning people into forced laborers to gather ivory and then even more so wild rubber.
As the Belgians were pursuing ivory and rubber, though, they discovered lots of gold deposits, diamonds, copper, cobalt, and many other minerals.
So, since 1885, Congo has been caught in the midst of a geostrategic battle, primarily for her natural resources.
Part of its ongoing conflict has been the desire by different armed groups and neighboring countries to benefit, to get rich, to make money from those particular minerals.
These resources that are found in the Congo are vital to major industries in the West, whether we're talking about the automotive industry, aerospace industry, technology industry, the electronics industry, even the jewelry industry.
These minerals exist in great profusion throughout the Democratic Republic of Congo, especially in its eastern part. And this is the largest territory on Earth which really doesn't have a functioning government.
People can say anything, but the Congo is still a police state. There is no freedom of the press. You hear people being killed. The army is not an army. You know, this is a bunch of people who are indisciplined, who still roam the streets.
But all this 125 years must be taken into consideration to fully understand why Congo is in a weakened state today. If we look from 1885 to 1908, we're talking about personal rule, enslavement. From 1908 to 1960, colonialism, Congo under colonial rule. Congo finally elects its leader in 1960, and in 61 was assassinated. So we have assassination. Then a dictator was put over the people for another 3 decades. So now we have dictatorship. Then an invasion was backed from the outside with Rwanda and Uganda in 1996 that Congolese people suffer from to this day. So we have 125 years of this. Now what that does is it destroys and eviscerates the Congolese institutions.
And when you have great wealth, no government, it's an open invitation, and it's been a sort of a free-for-all war as rival warlords surrounding African countries like Rwanda and Uganda in the east have just gone in there and helped themselves to this enormous natural wealth.
Since 1996, the conflict in Congo has claimed the lives of an estimated 6 million people. Today, neighboring governments continue plundering by using proxy forces to displace entire communities for access to the land.
Maiko mambo ya kusema wao rarako ndio mambo yako napigana. Basha shuka mpaka hivi. Kiumba yote doki kiumba iko hapa nayo inatombe. Njoki ona population yote ya kiumba wote wanakimbia.
Scenes like this are often misunderstood as simply the result of an ethnic war, a mistake that only benefits those trying to hide their illegal exploits.
It has nothing to do with ethnicity. They killed Congolese like they were flies. You see how people, you feel a mosquito and just hit? That's exactly how they killed. It did not mean anything to them how they were killing the Congolese, as long as we can just wipe them out and get access. I mean, the mines exist. People used to live in those areas. Have we ever asked who was living where the mine was before? Did the mine just show up? No, there were villages where those mines were.
From 1996 to the present, an estimated 6 million dead. Abject poverty. People living in bestial conditions. Hundreds of thousands of women systematically raped as a strategy of war.
Rape happened to be one of the weapons that worked the most. Because as soon as you destabilize a community, you rape the the entire village, the women of the entire village, in front of the children, in front of the husband, in front of the neighbors. That community is broken completely. Because the men cannot look at the wives in the eye and say, we were unable to protect you. And the women cannot survive that trauma.
Congo is one of the worst places in the world to be a woman or a girl. And one of my recent trips to Congo, I met up with a young girl who was 15 years old. She had been violently raped by one of the rebel groups, and she had been held for 3 months in a hole in the ground, in a pit, naked. And every day, another combatant would come and rape her. She was only 15. She realized at one stage that she had fallen pregnant. And then they killed her best friend, who was in the pit with her. There were two of them. And she had to stay in that pit with the body for 6 weeks, unable to climb out of the pit, knowing that she was pregnant and still being raped day in, day out.
Since 1996, hundreds of thousands of Congolese women and girls have been raped, and the violence is escalating. Their attackers are foreign or Congolese, the lines between them blurred by years of greed, chaos, and impunity. As the women are broken, so is the community, a war strategy that leaves tens of thousands of people dead every month.
They reduce you to a non-human, in essence. People are being reduced to a non-human so that they cannot think. They can feel powerless. They can feel hopeless, so they can give up.
Imagine, I mean, you may not even be able to put your wrap your mind around it, but imagine nearly 6 million people dying in the middle of Europe, and yet we're silent.
Millions of Congolese people have lost their life as a result of the crises that we've been discussing, and it has warranted almost no sustained and enterprising reporting from the media of the world. It has obtained no great purchase on the popular imagination. Millions of people dead.
Why is it that nobody's talking about it? This is the same international community that said, you know, when there was a Holocaust, that no more genocide would take place, and yet the same community left Rwanda genocide take place, and yet those who committed genocide in Rwanda crossed over in the Congo, and the Congo has become the victim of what happened in Rwanda, and what the international community didn't do to stop it.
In 1994, the international community failed to stop the Rwandan genocide and effectively punish its perpetrators. Since then, violence in Central Africa has escalated, along with a growing culture of impunity.
If you don't hold to account those who carry out these horrible atrocities, it leaves the door open for them to do more.
Free to flee the country, hundreds of militants crossed over into Congo for fear of retribution from the Tutsi-led rebellion that took power in Rwanda. The militants were hidden among millions of predominantly civilian Hutu refugees trying to escape the violence in their country.
The refugee camps, which had over 1 million people in them, were being controlled by these very same genocidaires, these people who had committed the genocide.
Paul Kagame, who led the Tutsi rebellion and was now in charge of Rwanda, saw these militant refugees as a threat to Rwandan national security.
He came to Washington, D.C., and essentially said, if the international community is not going to do it, we're going to take things into our own hands. The U.S. had no official response to that, which he interpreted as a green light.
In the absence of justice, a terrifying cycle of revenge was about to take hold in Congo, as Paul Kagame's army prepared to massacre what many experts estimate to be hundreds of thousands of refugees.
And reports started coming in about atrocities that had been committed, in which they had slaughtered thousands of Hutu civilians. Now, believe me, I have no sympathy whatsoever for these genocidaires, these Interahamwe guys who had, committed the genocide in Rwanda. But the civilians, obviously, the children, the women, are you kidding? Why would they be victimized by this?
These Hutu were not combatants. They were not people under arms. They were elderly, They were women, they were children, they were sick people who were killed in a systematic and highly motivated way, and the UN knew about it almost in real time.
The UN knew, the US government knew, I believe other governments knew as well. They did not make an effort to openly investigate those, or not good enough. They allowed investigations to be blocked and they didn't push it. Now the question can be asked, why was that the case? And of course, part of the difficulty here was that many policymakers felt guilty. They hadn't done enough to stop the Rwandan genocide, and that genocide guilt allowed them to cover this up.
That guilt manifested in the Clinton era in an extremely pro-Rwanda policy, which essentially allowed the new government in Rwanda to do whatever they wanted, both within their country and within Congo, with impunity.
With the leaders of the United States and the United Nations looking the other way, Kagame proceeded with a full-scale invasion of Congo with his Ugandan ally, Yoweri Museveni.
So the question is, what role did the U.S. play in this? And it was a pretty direct supporting role. I happened to go to Rwanda just before this invasion took place. And, you know, major shipments of weapons were coming in at night to support the Rwandan army. We had placed people in the country who were training Rwandan army troops. In short, we were supporting the invasion.
The United States, what they decided to do in the final analysis was to support an invasion of the Congo.
In this case, you had Rwanda and Uganda invading their neighbor, plundering it of its natural resource wealth, and suffering no sanctions at the United Nations Security Council. And you have to ask why. And it's because they had the very strong support and backing of the United States, United Kingdom, and other governments.
The reason the United States supported Rwanda and Uganda in their invasion of Congo cannot simply be attributed to genocide guilt. The U.S. had economic and political motivations as well. One reason for our involvement extended back to our support of Mobutu Sese Seko, a dictator we helped install in Congo and supported for 32 years.
This man bled his country dry. He extracted even more money from it than King Leopold did in his time, but Mobutu had a longer reign and a much more developed economy to plunder. And the United States was deeply complicit in that because we supported Mobutu lock, stock, and barrel.
But after the Cold War ended, essentially in 1989, 1990, many of his backers, including the United States government and the French government, essentially abandoned him. He became a liability to them because he had such a bad human rights record.
When Mobutu became an embarrassment, we helped Rwanda and Uganda overthrow him and install another dictator, and another. Now the Congolese people are victims of a corrupt dictatorial network which receives financial support from the United States.
They have looted the place outrageously, you know, taking hundreds of millions of dollars in minerals, sponsoring some of the worst warlords, and with never a protest from Washington.
The role the U.S. plays in Central Africa is complex. Historically, we've maintained influence in the area for access to minerals on which our economy and military rely, but our connection to Rwanda serves our interests in yet another way.
A problem here is really a problem of political will in the United States. Why is Rwanda and why are Uganda important to the U.S. military? Precisely because we can have them do things in Africa that we don't wish to do ourselves. We can have their soldiers die if need be. We can have them deploy places if need be. And so having proxies, having allies, having clients who are willing to do your bidding becomes very important.
The disciplined and organized armies of Rwanda and Uganda are useful for protecting American interests in Africa. Similarly, friendships with dictators are easier to manage than complex, thriving democracies. For generations, the way the United States has been involved in Central Africa has helped perpetuate tyranny and dependency.
So, when you see these prescriptions coming out of Washington and they say, well, we've tried everything, you know, we support peacekeepers, we've had peace talks, it's usually within the parameters of maintaining the current order.
This has serious implications in terms of what people don't talk about, U.S. foreign policy. That's where the problem lies. It has something to do with the United States and Great Britain supporting strong men in Africa rather than supporting the people.
That's easy to point fingers and to pin the blame of these problems on others. Yes, a colonial map that made little sense helped to breed conflict. The West has often approached Africa as a patron or a source of resources rather than a partner. But the West is not responsible for the destruction of the Zimbabwean economy over the last decade. Or wars in which children are enlisted as combatants.
But now, Obama, when he went to Ghana, he had a huge speech, you know, that really woke up Africans. You know, he was very harsh. He was almost as a dad telling the kids, you guys need to get your act together. You know, you can't have election here and spring of some elections there and call that democracy. That was good for him to say that, saying that, you know, he's demanding that there are some accountability for political leaders in Africa. But he said something that still stick with me today. He said that America is ready to support strong institutions, but not strong men.
Africa doesn't need strong men. It needs strong institutions. As for America and the West, our commitment must be measured by more than just the dollars we spend. I pledge substantial increases in our foreign assistance, which is in Africa's interests and America's interests. But the true sign of success is not whether we are a source of perpetual aid that helps people scrape by. It's whether we are partners in building the capacity for transformational change.
So, there are a whole series of things that can be done, keeping in mind that the ultimate solution is going to come from the Congolese people themselves. Our role on the outside is to make sure that we create the space for them to solve and address the challenges that they face.
There's a strong desire for democracy in Congo, with leaders poised to start fixing their country. But key to their success is international pressure on Rwanda and Uganda to stop their destructive intervention. President Obama seems to understand this. For years, he has been an advocate for Congo, and as a senator, he co-sponsored a law that outlines a comprehensive strategy for Congo to realize justice. But key elements of this law have not been fully implemented.
So, President Obama wrote a law to support the Congo, signed into law in 2006 by George Bush, the president then, co-sponsored by the Secretary of State today. That law is the most comprehensive law you can think about when it comes to supporting the Congo. Now, we have a law that says that the Secretary of State has the power to withhold aid to any nation deemed to be destabilizing the Congo if she has sufficient evidence that this country is doing so. We have so many evidence on Rwanda and Uganda, and we even have a leaked UN report that all the Secretary of State have to do is read it and say, okay, we are not going to support you. But since 2000, the United States have given Rwanda $1 billion. The leaked UN report is calling this government a genocidal government. Why is the United States supporting a genocidal government?
And it doesn't have to be that way. You do not have to slaughter millions of people to get access to the cobalt for your colored television, or access to the cobalt for your aerospace industry,
or access to the copper for your automobile industry.
All right. You dealing with the economy. You want the coltan. Man, Congolese people don't eat coltan. Congolese people can't eat gold. Talk to the Congolese people. We're going to let you get the resources, but for God's sake, stop killing the people. Stop letting Rwanda, Uganda, and Joseph Kabila kill with impunity.
The situation in the Congo is not just a Congolese issue. It's not just an African issue, but it's a global issue. It's a worldwide issue. Congo is a part of the second largest rainforest in the world. It's vital to the fight against climate change. If you're concerned about climate change, you should be concerned about Congo. Half of those who have died as a result of the conflict are children under the age of 5. So if you're a child advocate, if you're concerned about children, you ought to be concerned about what's happening in the Congo. If you're concerned about women, if you have a mother, a sister, you ought to be concerned about what's happening in the Congo. If you drive an automobile, or fly in airplanes, or own a cell phone, as a human being, at the very least, you ought to be concerned. You ought to say something. You ought to want to find out why this is happening. You ought to be moved to want to bring an end to it.
The U.S. military and Congress try to piece together what led to the deaths of American servicemen in Niger earlier this month. It seems many lawmakers in the states have no idea about their troop presence in that African country. 3 weeks ago, a group of American and local troops were attacked in Niger by ISIL fighters. 4 U.S. servicemen and 10 Nigerian soldiers were killed in that ambush. The Pentagon says the group had no full air support until 2 hours after the battle began. According to estimates, Niger has the second largest U.S. military presence in Africa, 800 out of the total 6,000 troops across the continent. Djibouti is in first place with 4,000 servicemen. Then comes Somalia and Cameroon with 400 and 300 soldiers, respectively. However, it will soon be difficult to tell how many total troops the U.S. has across the world, as Samira Khan reports.
So it's official. Washington has intervened in so many different countries, even U.S. senators seem to have lost track.
But I didn't know there was 1,000 troops in Niger. This is an endless war without boundaries, no limitation on time and geography.
And Senator Graham's not the only one.
You heard Senator Graham there. He didn't know we had 1,000 troops in Niger. Did you?
No, I did not.
And there you have it. Two sitting senior senators, one Republican and the other a Democrat, had no idea the U.S. currently has over 1,000 troops in Niger. So how's this possible? Past administrations have used the Authorization for Use of Military Force Against Terrorists, or the AUMF, to warrant military operations involving non-state actors or terror organizations. Passed by Congress right after September 11th, it allows the president to use force against those who planned, committed, or aided the 9/11 attacks. And only one person voted against it, Congresswoman Barbara Lee.
Let's step back for a moment. Let's just pause just for a minute and think through the implications of our actions today so that this does not spiral out of control.
According to a 2016 Congressional Research Office report, the Bush and Obama administrations used the AUMF on 37 occasions to initiate military action in over a dozen countries. And now with Trump, it appears there's even less oversight. The Pentagon has just announced that they will no longer disclose troop numbers in Iraq and Syria. But can this apply to other regions besides Iraq and Syria?
There was already consistent, considerable complaint about lack of transparency and accountability during the Obama administration, and now it's gotten significantly worse. And Trump has touted this as a reform. Like, I've reformed this policy under my wonderful reform. You're going to have even less information about how many troops there are in various places and what they're doing.
When the former defense secretary and CIA director Leon Panetta was once asked about how many wars the U.S. was engaged in, he seemed rather lost.
It's a good question. You know,
you have to stop and count.
I'll have to stop and think about that.
Now, with very little transparency on U.S. operations overseas, it may not exactly be quite the subject to laugh about. Samira Khan, RT, Washington, D.C.
When the white men first came here from over the seas, he looked and he said, this is God's own country. He was mighty well pleased with this land that he found, and he said, I will make him my own piece of ground. Now many's the battle he still had to fight, and many's the family one fine day in 1883, gold was discovered in good quantity. Now the country was rich and was richer than planned, and each digger wanted his own piece of land. White diggers were few and the gold was so deep. This land is so rich and it seems strange to me that the black man whose labor has helped it to be cannot enjoy the fruits that are bound. He's uprooted and kicked from his own piece of land. Why some people say, now don't you worry, we'll get you in piece of reserve territory, but I'll give my love that 10 million can be found on a miserable 30% of the ground. Yes, some people say, no, don't you worry, you can always find jobs in the white man's city, but don't stay too long. You're bound to disturb the white man in his sleep. White men don't sleep long and don't sleep too deep. For your life and possessions, how long will you keep? 'Cause I've had a rumor that's running around, for the black man's
fountain of hope, living water for each of us. There, rivers of dreams heartache of this place. There are children and flower the trees. There are voices of people who need this place.
sorrow and sadness here, but there's heaven and sunshine too. The spirit of peace moves free and clear, making way for laughter here. There are children that flower the trees. There are voices of people who believe in this place. They live and breathe in this place, yeah.
And you've been listening to Wake Up Call. My name is Bernard White. I do want to thank you for stopping by with us today. And hopefully we were able to clarify some things for you, plus give you some additional things to think about. Coming up next here at CPR will be Weekday World with Don DeBar. So make sure you stay tuned for that. And as always, until next time, stay strong, pay close attention, and never give up.
Away. There are children that flower the trees. There are voices of people who need this place. Oh, yeah. They wanna be in this place, yeah. They live and breathe in this place. Oh, 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 this place.